Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 250.
Gutus.
Rocky Mountains. British officers bicker before Zulu snipers target an entomologist hunting beetles. First, a quick note, which the marketing weasel ordered me to announce. This week I received an email from Apple which read, "We're thrilled to share some incredible news. History of South Africa podcast has been selected by our editors as one of Apple Podcasts' best shows of 2025. Congratulations on this fantastic achievement and for creating one of the most compelling shows of the year. We are so excited to spotlight your work." Wow, that gives me a shot in my ego. Nothing will. So to all the listeners and my supporters who are wonderful, and your comments which have been fantastic and supportive, and the suggestions which are even better, may we continue to survive the present in order to understand the past and the future. 250 is what is known in maths as a five smooth number. None of its prime factors are greater than five. Factor 250, that is 250 divided by 2, equals 125. So the prime factors are all five or less. Strange but true. Culturally, 250 is fascinating too. In Mandarin slang, Chinese, the number 250 pronounced bai wu is an insult meaning idiot or simpleton, which is apt because a certain American president, number 47, who's referred to as bai wu in China, is going to preside over his country's 250th birthday celebrations in 2026. When we left off last episode, a British column of the 1st and 24th and the 2nd and 24th, a host of irregular mounted men of the Natal Carbineers, the Natal Native Contingent, and the Native Pioneers, and their commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Glynn, had entered Zululand by way of Rorke's Drift and approached KwaSokgetle, the home of Amakungubeni Inkosi Sihayo. 4,700 British troops and support personnel, 220 wagons, 2,000 oxen, 82 carts, 67 mules. It took over an hour for this column to pass a point. It was so large. And as you heard too, Gletshwayo Khampande had decided that because this column was the largest, it was going to get special Amabuto treatment. Tagging along, you'll remember, is the only journalist covering this war, Noggs Norris Newman. All were approaching Sihayo's KwaSokgetle homestead, but there was no sign of the Amakungubeni, nor their chief. Lord Chelmsford had arrived at Halk Makar on the eve of the invasion, and had technically taken over as commander of this column, which was to increase tension amongst the officers. Chelmsford tended to micromanage, and Glynn was highly experienced. Later, when a catastrophe unfolded, controversy would rage about who in fact was in charge. Glynn was already resentful that his role had been usurped. If you recall last episode, I explained how he'd put together the regiment in England, paid for his colonelcy, then led the regiment through the end of the 9th Frontier War. And here was Chelmsford and his retinue taking over. It appears Chelmsford was oblivious to the chagrin, which increased when Chelmsford held closed-door meetings with his own staff officers and left Glynn and his officers out of the tent to urinate in, so to speak. Glynn found himself acting as a kind of inflated sergeant major, supervising camp guards, cleaning the camp, inspecting the troops. It grated on the waxed, mustachioed military man. C-suite tensions. There's a correlation between the military and corporate relationships, and business schools are often full of ex-military folks. Glynn's staff officer, Major Cornelius Francis Clary, had taken part in the campaign against Chief Sekokuni of the Bapedi and was known to be vindictive and a bit of a gossip. On the other hand, Chelmsford's military secretary, Lieutenant Colonel John North Krellick, had served in India and was waspish and unpleasant, although he regarded himself as a talented watercolour artist. You know, the Victorian ethos, blood and paint splattered across the empire, death and art, bizarre. Both Cleary and Krellick corresponded with Head of Military Intelligence in London, Major General Sir Archibald Allison. Krellick didn't waste words. Behind Glynn's back, he hacked out a dispatch that read, "Clary is here with Colonel Glynn, and high time too. Do not expect anything from the latter. He's a regimental officer with no idea beyond it. Cleary was also feverishly composing behind the back claps to Major Allison, complaining that Cleary was acting beyond his scope.
Craylock acted as adjutant general to Lord Chelmsford, and all patrols, reconnaissance, etc., were detailed by the general himself.
By the way, that little bit of information was going to add to the weight of evidence against Chelmsford later. It's always the castaway comment that clinches the deal. It was not a good sign that both parties started this invasion by finger-pointing in an abject and somewhat juvenile way. A series of clumsy mistakes were going to add up. One of the biggest mistakes Chelmsford made was in connection with the Natal Carbineers, colonials, who had volunteered to cross into Zululand under strict conditions. They would not be led by anyone other than Colonel Dartnell, who was more colonial than British soldier by this stage, and their rate of pay was high. However, Chelmsford had a friend, a special service officer and former aide-de-camp to Prince of Wales, Captain John Cecil Russell of the 12th Lancers he was, and in an extremely unwise move, Chelmsford made Russell commander of the colonial volunteers instead of Dartnell. Noggs Norris Newman followed Captain Theophilus Shepston, the son of Theophilus Shepston the Elder, who you've met, because Theophilus the Younger, when he heard about the order back in Halbmacard, he galloped off to the volunteer camp on the eve of the invasion. Ordering all to fall in, he briefed them on the change in leadership, then asked for comments from the stunned volunteers.
"Do you accept Captain Russell as your commander or no?"
asked Shepston Jr. sharply.
"No,"
came the retort. "Mutiny, or at least a close cousin." When Chelmsford heard about this, he was in a bit of a quandary. He couldn't lose face by rescinding his order, and he couldn't lose the critical support of the mounted force by charging them with mutiny, as he had no proper cavalry himself. Instead, he proposed that Dartnell be promoted to his staff as cavalry advisor. Better pay, better food, improved CV. Dartnell accepted, then asked the volunteers if they wouldn't mind very much, old chap, serving under Captain Russell, and the crisis was over, but not for long. Later, Russell's questionable behaviour when confronting the enemy, by questionable, I mean cowardly, would see him relegated to the rank of major and put in charge of a depot in Pietermaritzburg. Forgive this interlude, it's for a reason, as you'll hear through the next few episodes. The friction between leadership at a time of war is possibly the most destructive force inside an organization that has an existential external enemy. After all, Harvard Business School game theory is only useful when the bullets aren't fired in your direction. Here we are, Shepston leading the Central Column Number 3, as it was known, with Glynn glowering. Column 1 was on the right flank down the coast, crossing the Lower Tugela with 5,000 men under Colonel Charles Pearson. Comprised of the Naval Brigade, 2nd, 3rd, 60th Rifles, the 99th Regiment, the Natal Native Contingent, and Artillery. Column 2 was Durnford's, although technically it was more closely attached to Glynn's Column 3, and both 2 and 3 were said to operate more closely than Pearson's first column, which was to head to the Lower Tugela, cross the mighty river opposite the Zulu kraal at Gingindlovu, advance to Ishowe, and push on to Ondini. However, Pearson had been told to advance cautiously and to consolidate his men in Ishowe before continuing. He would end up besieged in Ishowe. He had moved so slowly. Durnford's column two was comprised of a mixture of forces, including mounted Basutu cavalry, the Natal native contingent, and a small force of imperial soldiers. He was told to march in the area between Pearson's column in the lowlands and Glynn higher up, operating as a kind of stabilizing force. Chelmsford was going to repeatedly retask Durnford, and he was not too tightly integrated into Glynn's line of march, so that was rather an unstable than a stabilizing force. Prior to the crossing, Chelmsford had set out a scale for the distribution of cattle seized, prize money, he called it. He had conferred with Colonel Wood prior to the invasion. They had rendezvoused between Bemba's Kop and Rock's Drift. Chelmsford offered Wood the political office of resident of Zululand after the war. The British commander had read Karl von Clausewitz's famous treatise called On War, where he said war is the continuation of politics by the means. Wood could slip into something more comfortable after the war, said Chelmsford, like Zululand. Wood politely refused. saying he was a better soldier than an administrator. That didn't stop Wood from looting. Within a few days of crossing into Zululand, he'd amassed 7,000 head of cattle and sent 2,500 straight to the Free State to be sold. In terms of the regulations, this was a dubious act and devious. Prior to the crossing, Chelmsford had appeared to be genuinely concerned that the local people should be treated well by his invading columns, a kind of hearts and minds attitude. While officially justified as spoils of war, it blurred the line between sanctioned requisition and profiteering. To the Zulus, whose wealth and status were measured in cattle, this was not a mere foray, but a desecration, a calculated humiliation that struck at the core of their economy and their pride. To some, among Wood's own officers, it looked less like disciplined campaigning and more like opportunistic looting, an echo of the blurred Victorian frontier where commerce, soldiering, and moral rectitude rarely marched in step. The white troops were told to be courteous of their allies, the Natal native contingent, and behave courteously to non-combatants on the Zulu side. Chelmsford had issued general regulations, and under paragraph 9 it read, "Natives will be treated with kindness. Mining officers will exert their influence with all ranks to prevent their being in any way molested or oppressed." Once inside Zululand, these high-flown ideals were disregarded. As soon as they entered the Zulu side of the border, any village was fair game. Thus, the arrival at Sehayo's homestead, KwaSokgetle, less than a day's march across Rorke's Drift. Sokgetle was a natural flat-topped fortress which rose over 1,000 feet from the valley floor, its approaches strewn with boulders, steep and seemingly impregnable. The British faced a tough assignment. Had Cetshwayo Kampane, or Chief Sehayo, decided to defend the citadel to the full, the battle would have no doubt been far more bloody. But the fortress was defended by only a small group of Sehayo's men, including one of his youngest sons in Nkombi Kazulu. Most warriors, including Sehayo himself and all his other sons, had marched off to Undini, 116 kilometers away, to join the main Zulu army. On the afternoon of the 11th of January, the British had bivouacked inside Zululand, and Chelmsford gave orders for an attack on KwaSokgetle the following day. At 3:30 a.m. on the 12th, 100 horsemen each from the Imperial Mounted Infantry and the Natal Carbineers, as well as infantry of the 1st and 3rd Natal Native Contingent, plus four companies of Glynn's 1st and 24th, set off for the rocky part of the Ngutu Range that dominates Rorke's Drift. The reserve force of NNC and 2nd 24th were left at the base near the drift as reinforcements. 300 cavalry and 1,800 foot soldiers were going to battle. Facing them were fewer than 100 Zulu warriors. British had no idea how many they faced, but the warriors on the high ground could see the full might of the British Empire approaching. The British advanced in skirmishing order, two companies of the 1st and 24th at the head of the attack seeking to probe enemy positions. They walked 10 paces apart or less, depending on the terrain, while about 200 metres behind, the main force approached. A reserve battalion was in the rear. These were lined up in close order march, more tightly bunched, so that they could be directed into battle like a fist punch. When attacked, the skirmishers operated in pairs at the front. One fired while the other observed and reloaded, and they were mutually responsible for each other. This was one of the innovations the British Army had introduced fighting colonial wars. Every ounce of cover was taken, termite mounds, rocks, even bushes. But right now, there was no firing. Chelmsford's orders: only shoot when you're shot at. The troops halted as they closed in on the hill so that Chelmsford and Glynn could figure out their final plan of attack. The Imperial soldiers were marched off to the left and the mounted colonials to the right, around the mountain in an attempt to cut off any Zulu warrior retreating east. In the centre, the men of the NNC, the black troops, would be committed to the direct assault, led by Commandant Maori Hamilton Brown, as he was called. A typical man of his time, Maori Hamilton Brown was what you could call a mercenary, a soldier of fortune knocking about the world, attracted to trouble spots fighting for empire. Chelmsford was observing the advance and then beckoned Hamilton Brown over.
"Commandant Brown, those kranzes are full of cattle. Take them, but on no account are you to fire before you are fired at."
Zulu Amabutu were hidden behind rocks, chanting and singing. Some stood, and their silhouettes could be seen clearly in the early morning air, as the sounds echoed off the labyrinthian rocks and ravines. The Zulu were standing with the sun behind their backs, an ideal position to defend against attack early in the morning and late in the afternoon. The British were squinting in the bright sunlight. 1,200 NNC soldiers in identical dress to the Zulu, except for their red headbands, jogged forward. Behind them, the redcoats marched. When both sides were close enough to hear each other, the singing stopped, and a voice called out in Zulu, asking by whose orders the white impi had come. Hamilton Brown's interpreter, Captain Dunscombe, shouted back in Zulu something like, "Ingomyalo, wedlovukazi imhlophe inkulu." By orders of the Great White Queen, which was not true. Sir Bartle Frere, the Cape Governor, had not informed the Colonial Office nor the British government that war had been declared. Obviously, the Great White Queen Victoria had not issued orders. But for the soldiers who heard him, it was the thought that counted rather than the fact of the matter. As Dunscombe's reply echoed off the rocks, the Zulu opened fire with a variety of ancient weapons, muskets, particularly the old British Tower pattern musket, and some rifles. A half dozen NNC soldiers were hit, and they went down. Most others dropped behind cover, while a handful charged forward towards the V-shaped cleft in the mountain. Only a single company of NNC followed Hamilton Brown into the labyrinth, and this company was special. It was they who'd only recently survived Cetewayo's first fruits battles of the previous year. They were motivated to seek revenge even when faced with extreme personal danger. The NNC began winkling out the Zulu warriors, who retreated into the caves and the rocks further back. Above them were sheer cliffs. They were trapped inside this V-shaped ravine. The retreating Zulu fired a heavy volley at the advancing NNC and then dropped behind cover. Hamilton Brown and a small section of the Isikhosa charged the rocks and made it inside the jumbled maze, but the rest of the battalion had gone to ground. Now they were alone. A desperate hand-to-hand fight ensued with Chief Nkumbuka Zulu's men. It was diamond cutting diamond, shield against shield, as the NNC and the Zulu clashed inside this confined space, assegai meeting assegai, grunts as the spears found their mark, while Hamilton Brown lashed out with his sword and fired off his revolver. "The enemy fought splendidly, but my men were not to be denied," he said later. Eventually, the warriors were pinned at the back of this V-shaped ravine and asked to be allowed to let their women and children out safely. They surrendered with their families, along with the cattle, and by some miracle, none of the women or children had been hurt in the firefight. Little did the forward group of NNC and Hamilton Brown know, but a larger Amabutu had gathered further up the mountain and were about to launch their own attack. NNC commanding officer Wilson Black, a Scotsman, saw the danger and ran out of cover, waving his hat in one hand and his sword in the other, which is an almost suicidal thing to do in the middle of a firefight. A Zulu sniper duly took aim and shot the hat out of Black's hand. He bent down and picked up the shredded hat, continuing to shout. Another warrior higher up rolled a large rock down the side, which careered into Black's torso, hitting him below the belt, so to say. And he doubled up in agony. After a few moments, he staggered back to his feet, swearing in Gaelic, his Scots voice ricocheting off the cliffs. The reality of war swept this light-hearted moment away. Terrible scenes of death covered the area inside the labyrinth around the tabletop. Perhaps the sight of one of his men slashed almost in half by an assegai triggered Lieutenant Harford of the 99th Regiment, although his actions up to that moment had been eccentric, to say the least. He had never been under fire before, and before the battle, he had told others he wondered if he had the guts, hoping he would remain cool. During this battle, he startled other officers when he fell to the ground, dropping his sword and revolver. "Are you hit?" they asked. "No," he replied, "not hit, but have caught such a beauty." There, the lunatic, as some called him later, had captured a small beetle, and under heavy fire, the musket balls pinging off the rocks around him, he began to blow on its wings, mimicking its flight, as if he was in his garden at home. Harford began to expound on the incredible find, rattling off the insect's Latin name, oblivious to the carnage, or perhaps seeking some kind of solace from science. Harford was ordered to get up and take his flanking company off to the right to ensure the Amabutu did not withdraw. And with some sorrow, he gently placed the bug in a tin box and ran off. His eccentric behaviour didn't end there. It was clear that a handful of Zulu snipers had managed to pin down the 1,200 British and NNC troops, and these Zulu snipers were operating from a cave close to the top of the mountain. Troops of the 2nd 24th were expending precious rounds trying to pick them off, but missing. By now, bodies lay scattered around and on the rocks, some hanging from the creepers and the bush. A horrifying scene of carnage. Harford ran towards the scene and climbed along the side of the hanging rocks, wounding his way between the corpses. Then he came to an overhanging ledge. Managing to lever his way up and over, a Zulu warrior leapt into view and jammed the muzzle of his musket into Harford's face and pulled the trigger, but it misfired. The warrior dropped the musket and disappeared into a cave. Harford emptied his revolver into the cave and began to reload, but somehow contrived to drop his revolver and the rounds over the edge of the mountain. The weapon skittered down the side of the rocks, tinkering out of sight below. Now Harford was unarmed and in the lion's den. He peered into the darkness of the cave and spotted his recent attacker squatting nearby, but he had given up. There were two other wounded men within, and after some cajoling, three more men appeared. Harford took the four down the mountain as prisoner of war to present to a somewhat bemused Chelmsford. The two wounded were left where they lay and succumbed to their wounds. Meanwhile, the mounted soldiers had ridden around the right of the mountain, passed over a neck, a ridge, and caught the impi from behind. Many Zulu soldiers were riding horses and managed to gallop away. Moments later, another group of warriors appeared. They were the NNC, who had discarded their red bandanas. Fortunately, both parties recognized each other at the last minute and avoided a case of friendly fire. The chaos of war, indeed. Chelmsford, who had been watching the battle from amongst the rocks a few hundred meters away, decided it was time to order the reserve up from the base near Rorke's Drift, Mkumbukazulu, and about 60 warriors had managed to work their way up right to the high ground from the caves below. But the British had already arrived at the tabletop. Caught between the forward units and the British behind him, he and 60 warriors charged into Shepston's volunteer carbineers in an act of extreme courage. The carbineers fired a volley, killing Mkumbukazulu and 10 of his men. The rest finally broke and scattered. Down in the valley, Chelmsford's reserves of the 2nd and 24th, the 2nd and 3rd NNC, swept through the Amakungabeni mealie fields all the way to the main homestead of Kwasokgetli. They expected the huts to be defended to the death, but Sehayo was nowhere to be found. As we know, he was already with Gachwao. The huts were torched, while a wagon was also found there in excellent condition, loaded with firearms, but too heavy to move. Chelmsford gave the order to cease fire and recall his troops. Over 30 Zulu warriors lay dead. About 24 were wounded. Dozens of prisoners were taken, but they were mainly old men and women and children. The British had lost 2 NNC men killed, 20 wounded, and managed to seize 500 cattle. The colonials had warned of a stiff fight and were surprised. But then they pointed out that only a handful of warriors had been left behind to defend Sahayo's homestead. The British commander, however, flushed with victory, overlooked that fact. That night, by a flickering lamp, Chelmsford wrote,
"I am in great hopes that the news of storming Sahayo's stronghold and the capture of so many of his cattle may have a salutary effect in Zululand, and either bring down a large force to attack us, or else produce a revolution in the country."
He had developed an unhealthy point of view. He was scorning the Zulu, which was a bad mistake. Further east, at Undini, the Zulu army had been ritually prepared for war and left Kwa Nodwengu late in the afternoon of Friday, 17th of January, 1879. The energetic Unukenke regiment in the lead, they marched 10 kilometers in single file to bivouac across the White Mfulozi in the Amakusini Valley. The talk amongst the warriors was all about Fetchwayo's comment that they would take but a single day to finish off the British. Both armies were now convinced of the other's fragility, but it was to be the British who felt the sting of a major defeat first. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'll load an update about various episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for a little newsletter. Until next, Saligashi.